So, in particular, I hope that you all did this exercise, the first exercise on the tutorial, where you practiced again this counting of the large n counting and saw that again you get a string partition function. Even if you rescale the fields, you just need to do some different counting, but everything works out nicely. So, the purpose of today's lecture, at the end of this lecture, I want to arrive to this box. So, we will try to find compelling evidence that there is a gauge theory, which is called four-dimensional n equals four super Young Mills. So it's a gauge theory in four dimensions, which is great. We live in four dimensions. It has a lot of supersymmetry. That's what the n equals four stands for. And that gauge theory, the claim will be that it is exactly equal. It is dual. We can really use one description or another. The claim is that it's exactly dual to a string to strings in a curved space-time, which is ADS5 times S5, where S5 is a sphere of five dimensions, and ADS5 is an hypersphere of five dimensions, pseudosphere of five dimensions. Okay. So, again, as I said, so we will try to find evidence for this conjecture. And we will, for that, use some concepts that you have seen in the string theory course. And I can warn you that, irrespective of what we will do today, this lecture will be somehow independent from the previous ones. So the take-home message from this lecture is that there seems to be evidence for an equivalence between a gauge theory and a string theory, a very precise one. It will not be just a cartoon like the previous times where we just start drawing Feynman diagrams and we say, oh, very happy, I'm very happy, here is some string. Now it will be something very precise. But of course, just saying that two theories are the same is not very useful. Of course, we need a dictionary. So what does it mean that they are the same? If I compute something on this side, what do I need to compute on the other side to get something working? So today we will not work out a dictionary. We'll just find evidence for these two theories being the same. Tomorrow, what we will do is we will extract what are the obvious consequences of this remarkable duality. Namely, we will continue the more conceptual discussion of what does this duality tell us about holography, information paradox, and so on. And then, in the remaining of the lectures of the course, we will establish the dictionary, the precise dictionary. What do I compute on the gauge theory? What do I compute on the string theory? And we will be doing totally independent computations, totally honest computations in gauge theory, totally honest computations in string theory, and I will teach you techniques in string theory, techniques in gauge theory, and when possible, we will compare the two and see that ADS-CFT works remarkably. But again, we will not need any faith. We will just compute, learn, and see that it works. So the basic idea of this ADS-CFT correspondence is that we have two descriptions of the same system. And actually, there are simple examples where we could imagine something with a similar flavor. Consider, for example, that you have a very heavy proton. So let this be a heavy proton. And let this be an electron. And you want to study how does the electron deflect in the presence of the heavy proton. What is the trajectory? What path does it follow? What happens to the electron because of the presence of the heavy proton? So, okay, you know that the electron feels a Coulomb interaction due to the exchange of a photon. And this gives rise to the Coulomb potential V of R, which is minus alpha over R. So this is, of course, just the Coulomb potential. But, of course, there are many more stuff going on when the proton and the electrons are close to each other. So let's draw a few more diagrams. How many more do I want? I want four. We have, say, for example, there's lots of physics. We have a photon can be emitted off the electron, and we will not distinguish in the final state this the electron from an electron with a very, very light photon that comes with it. And these kind of processes, they have a name, which I don't know how to spell, but someone from Germany, I guess, can probably tell me. I don't even know how to write it. Yeah, I heard it. Who is it?
Bram Stranum.
Bram Stranum. Is it well spelled?
Almost.
Very good. So it's approximately equal to Bram Stranum. Then we have, say, vertex corrections, which start correcting the interaction. And we can have, say, self-energy stuff and so on. Now, suppose you are powerful enough and manage to resum this kind of stuff. What you will find out is that this potential gets corrected. Instead of being just the Coulomb potential, it starts getting corrections. You get some alpha over 4 square root of pi, and then some e to the minus twice mass of the electron times r over, say, mass of the electron times r to the power 3/2 plus dot, dot, dot. So, suppose then we want to study this electron going through this proton. So we have two options, you see. One option is, so let's sum all the Feynman diagrams. So we sum single photon, two photons being exchanged, three photons being exchanged, and so on. We start summing all these possible diagrams. So we have two scenarios. So either we use the Feynman diagram approach, or we consider the electron moving in a non-trivial background and by this non-trivial background I mean something very specific, I mean this potential V of R. You don't do both. You don't consider the potential and the proton at the same time. So either you consider, you suppose someone gave you already the exact potential, then you just consider the electron that moves not in the vacuum but in the presence of this potential. Or, no, you say it's moving in the vacuum, but it is interacting and exchanging all these Feynman diagrams with this heavy proton. And we will see that ADS-CFT is very much a correspondence of this sort. We will have either an approach that resembles very much exchanging Feynman diagrams and interacting through this exchange of Feynman diagrams, and that will be the gauge theory approach. Or we will have the other approach, which is we consider the effect of deforming the background, and then we simply move in a deformed background, and that will be the string theory approach. So we will see that the gauge theory and the string theory point of view in the ADS-CFT duality are very much like this approach A and approach B. Of course, this is all quite schematic for now. So let's approach string theory and think what could be the analog of a light electron and what could be the analog of a heavy proton. So the light electron will be some small string. A fundamental string is something small and light. What heavy objects do you know in string theory? Yeah, what else? What objects are not just a small wiggle of string, but rather something large?
Brains.
So let's try to think, let's be inspired by this example and consider string theory, where you also have brains, which are hyperplanes, where open strings end. So string theory is a theory where you have closed strings that move in what we call the ball. And we have open strings that end on the brain. So we have closed strings that can, you could have, say, two closed strings that merged into one closed string that goes here. The closed string could do something like this, where this point is now touching the brain. This point could open in two and you would get some open string. This open string could spread out and you get something like this. This open string could then do something like this, where now this point also touches the brain. It could then split in two, and so on. Then it could recombine again in one. It could become like this, and it could at some point emit again closed strings, and this would be time going through. And now, what we want to do is think again from this point of view. think that we can either have the strings interacting with the brain by summing over all possible histories of these open strings, all these possible processes, or we can think, okay, the brain, it will create some non-trivial background, and let's consider strings moving in this non-trivial background. And this will be precisely the ADS-CFT correspondence. So let me just draw this picture in a somehow nicer way, which is, for example, I can imagine, this is just some other kind of picture where I have, for example, this is just drawing the full world sheet. I have a closed string. It interacts with the brain like this. It could have some handles. It could have split into two and joined again, like here, for example, if you have, say, some single closed string that split into two and then joined again, something like that, interacts with the brain and comes out. Okay? And this is really the world sheet picture. So this is a picture where you have a world sheet, say, with one handle and one boundary. And in the presence of brains, this path integral over strings, where you sum over strings of different topologies, gets generalized and you sum over strings with a given, with different topologies and also different boundaries, which are basically how many times the strings interact with the brain. And what we have to do is consider not only that diagram over there, but also other diagrams where we can have, again, this closed string. It could interact, as I said, twice with the brain and then emit a closed string plus it could do something a bit crazier. Let me see if I can draw it. Suppose so what I want to do to draw here, I really don't know how one draws this. Let's see. It's probably like this. Do you see what I want to draw? I want to draw a surface where the string is approaching the boundary not only at this circle, but also at an inner one. You see? Can you visualize? Do you understand what I want to draw? Is it clear to everyone? Okay. Plus, tack, tack, tack. And you see that what happens here is that, what happens here is that, so let me make a pic, let me add some open strings to this picture just to make it clear that this is exactly a description of the picture above. Of course, we have here some closed string, and if we think here, you see that what this is there is some open string stretched from there to there. Okay? Now, this is what I get if I think of it from this point of view, but notice something that if I think of this picture from this point of view here, then what I have is not an open string, but a closed string. Is this clear? So if I cut it like this. So this is something important. We'll come back to this soon. But this is a statement of open-closed duality. Did you discuss this in the lectures? In string lectures? And this is this obvious statement, once you draw this picture, that the brains, they have simultaneously two important roles. On the one hand, open strings are the excitations of these D-brains. When we think of time in this direction, we see open strings moving in the D-brain, splitting, and so on. When we think of D-brains with time in this direction, D-brains are also emitters. They also emit closed strings. So these brains, they have this already built-in dualistic picture. From this point of view, from this direction, we have some open strings propagating. When we think from this direction, we have therefore this open strings propagating. When we think of these pictures from this direction, we have the brains, we have that the brains emit closed strings. And in particular gravitons, of course. Very much like the proton emits photons, the brains will in particular, we can think of this, all these interactions as emitting all these closed strings. And of course, as we sum of more and more interactions, emitting all these backgrounds is what, all these gravitons are exactly what is going to deform our background. And then the picture then is clear. So then we say that, okay, instead of summing over all these interactions with the brain, it should be possible to consider the propagation of a string, you see, still maybe with handles here, still maybe with handles, but now in a non-trivial background. So from this point of view, from this direction of these open strings, okay? So from this point of view of these open strings, we have, the brain degrees of freedom are described by open strings, and in particular at low energies, by only the massless strings, because the other ones have mass, just that, and that's nothing but gluons and photons and so on. So we have super young Mills. That's just the spectrum of open string theory, is the spectrum of young Mills. When we think of these brains from this point of view, on the other hand, we think of the brains as emitting states, which of course is the same of having some world sheet and you insert some operator. By the operator state correspondence, you know that if you have some world sheet with some boundary, you can do the path integral if you want, continue it, and that's equivalent to inserting an operator. Is this familiar? Are these words familiar? That inserting an operator, then if you do the path integral, create some wave function at some spheres which surrounds this operator. So similarly, if I have some surface, some line that ends here with some wave function, I can undo the path integral, do the path integral, and find out that it's equivalent to inserting some operator or some linear combination of operators. And summing over all these holes, again, if you want, this is just a picture to denote that, will give rise to something schematically. So this is an insertion of a vertex operator that produces this closed string. So this would be one of those vertex operators that creates the closed strings. And this would be, you insert many operators, they exponentiate. You have a gas of vertex operators and it exponentiates to some integral. You can put them anywhere on the world sheet. You integrate over your world sheet of some vertex operator. So you see what it is doing. By summing over all these possible holes, that you can put in any possible position, you are basically creating a coherent gas or a gas of gravitons that exponentiates. And what will it happen? What will happen is that in the string path integral, now you got an extra exponential of the potential. So basically, you deformed the string path integral, you deformed the action. So this is exactly, so this deforms the action, and that is the background. And this is, of course, what leads to an untrivial background. One second. So we have this description here, A, and this description here, B. So this is slightly closer to what we will call, given what we have done so far, the rigorous argument, because so far we are still in the level of just cartoons. But this A and B are exactly the analog of that A and B. And now what we want to do is understand what exactly is A, what exactly is B, how can we make this more precise? How can we compute the exact background? How many dimensions does this brain have? What's the background, and so on? Who wanted to ask a question? Yes, yeah. Mohamed.
I'm not sure if I understood what you mean by the converting this emitting brains to the spot integral.
So I'm saying that if you have a path integral where you insert one operator, and then two operators, and then three operators, and so on, if you sum this average inside the path integral, by summing over 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 operators, this exponentiates, and you basically get the original path integral where the action got deformed, because you got an extra exponential, which is where the action is. And you integrate, you put these holes anywhere on this world sheet. You put these holes everywhere, all possible ways where the string can attach to this brain. So you get exactly a correction to the Lagrangian. This V is really correcting the Lagrangian. The action is the integral also over the world sheet of some action. And this picture tells you that you are somehow deforming the action, deforming the Lagrangian by the insertion, by the presence of this brain. This brain emits all these closed strings that will then deform the action of the string. But then I can ignore completely the brain and just say, okay, I have a string that moves in whatever background I got. Yeah? Are you getting the physical picture? Very good. So now we move to the famous decoupling argument, which was due to Maldacena in 97. And basically what we want to understand now is what Super Young-Mills is in A. We want to understand what is the background in B, and so on. Okay. So first, let's try then to move towards understanding a bit better how can we get this non-abelian gauge theory versus this background in a more or less rigorous way. So our goal is again to end on that box there, but as you see, we are still a bit far away. So far, where is ADS5? Where is S5? It all looks very, very far away. So let's start by making the object really heavy, and as we will see in a moment, I actually think you, Freddy told you about this so-called Shanpatan factors, didn't he? So in order to have an unabelian gauge theory, we actually need to have not one brain, but many brains. But for now, let me motivate it by just saying that I want to make that the heavy proton really, really heavy, so I'll put many brains. But actually, with some insight, I could have guessed that I need many brains because I want an unabelian gauge theory with n number of colors, and n is exactly the number of brains. But that I will remind you in a second. So for now, let's consider not one brain, but a stack of brains, which are at the same position. And let's put n brains here. More precisely, let's put n d3 brains. So these are brains that have three spatial directions and time. What's the motivation for choosing d3 brains? Of course, it's because we live in 3+1 dimension. So here inside the brain, we have our 3+1 dimensions. And getting out of the brain, we have extra 6 dimensions of the superstring. Now, let me remind you that when you have a stack of brains, a string can start at a point and end up on a different brain. Right? It can start on a point and end on a different brain. So let this point be I and this point be j. Then the claim is that this is describing exactly a field phi, which can be a gluon or a scalar or whatever, but which the color indices, this matrix index that we have been discussing in the last lectures, are exactly I and j. So if you have n brains, you have n choices for the first index, n choices for the second index, and this is how you generate fields in the adjoint. You choose one leg of the open string to land on one brain, the other leg to end on the other brain. And of course, the string is not stretched or anything because all these brains are at the same position. This is just so that I can draw them. So all these states are massless. They have exactly the same mass. But furthermore, you have this extra choice. So there are n square possibilities of how to connect the first and the second. So when we have strings interacting, now this picture is very hard to draw, but let's suppose we have a scattering of strings in the brain. So let's suppose I have, this will be really tough to draw, but I think we will do it. So let's have 4 strings scattering, and these 4 strings are in these stacks of brains. So each leg of these strings is in its own brain, can be in its own brain. So now let's consider the simple possible process where I'm drawing only the endpoints of the string. Where you see this is a world sheet, so there is a surface here. So at each point there is a world sheet. But I've just drawn the lines where it intersects the boundary. So then you can complete it to be a surface. And so on. So why did I choose, in which situation would you draw the strings so close to each other? This tube so thin. When the tension of the string is large, then the endpoints they want to be close. So this is the kind of picture. So the above, I was not worried. You see the open string is stretching a lot. But if the string tension is large, this is actually the kind of picture that you would get. So this picture is somehow for large string tension. So these strings, they don't like to be separated apart very much. And they have some large string tension, and that's why they are never, the endpoints are never very separated.
Pedro?
Yes?
Just to make sure.
Yes.
The ends of these strings something the same brain or on different brain?
Very good. So the ends, they are on different brains. But then you see that for this picture to make sense, what happens is that the indices, the brains, of course, the endpoints, if they want to communicate with each other, if they want to know about each other, this line here must end on the same brain, right? This one here, this boundary here, can be on a different brain. But then this one must also be on the same brain. Not the same as this one necessarily, but the same. And this is exactly in one-to-one correspondence with just a fat graph that we would draw. Where, of course, this line, this index is the same as this, this the same as this, and this the same as this. And actually, if we will start drawing loops of strings, something like the middle picture that I was trying to draw there, but being not very successful, if I will try to draw some strings that go here, and we'll do something like this. Now I didn't even try to disguise. I immediately draw it exactly like a fat diagram. This would again describe some string. You see, this point of the string is in brain I. This is in brain J. Then this string here splits into two. One string where this endpoint is still in brain I. But you see that this endpoint might be on brain K and this on brain J. So what's happening with this string is that the string is here. One leg on one brain, one leg on the other brain, and then there is a third brain. So this is brain I, J, and K. And as it's moving in time, this bump here can do something like that. Is it clear? So I have here this endpoint is I, this endpoint is J. The string is just fluctuating, and then this endpoint is K, so they are allowed to split, but then the two endpoints will be on the same brain once it splits. So now, this is time, now it splits, and we end up with one brain that goes from I to K, and one brain that goes from K to J after splitting. And this is exactly what the Feynman diagrams do. You have ij, it's split into ik, it's split into jk, and so on. So in the limit of large string tension, the interactions of the open strings on the brains reproduce exactly the interactions of an unabelian gauge theory. This is how unabelian gauge theories emerge from stacking many D brains on top of each other. Okay? So this is the shunt pattern mechanism that Freddy told you about. Now you see that when the brains are interacting, this endpoint could go to brain K or K prime prime to any of the N brains, right? So this endpoint, it chose to go to brain K, but there was another one here and another one here. So also from the string picture, of course, I get a power of N whenever I have a closed loop. Because that just comes from when the brain splits and goes to K1, to K2, to K3, to K4, up to Kn. So I reproduce exactly the same large N combinatorics. What about G string? So N is clear. So N is clear, right? So N comes from the choice of brains. Then we have G and mu square, which in the matrix model was G string. But in unabelian gauge theories, where we had G string in the lecture, we would always write just G and mu square. That's where my confusion in the first lecture came from. Where does the powers of G string come from this picture? Remember that when you do the string path integral, you add the power of G string whenever you have a handle, right? This I told you, that if you have a closed string, whenever you have more and more handles, you put more and more powers of G string. What about holes? Holes, I did not tell you the prescription. So I told you that whenever you have a handle, you put a power of g-string square. If you go to your notes, you saw it was g-string to the power of 2 genus minus 2. Right? So it's a power of g-string square whenever I have a handle. What should be the power of g-string when I have a hole? Sorry? A hole is a boundary. When I have an extra boundary for my path integral, like there, for example, I have 2 boundaries. Or there, I have 1 boundary. You see? So what should be the power of g-string for this picture to be consistent?
The first power.
Sorry?
The first power.
Why the first power?
Because if you have a picture at hole, you can complete it on the other side by the mirror image, which gives you...
Exactly. Because if you want to make sense of unitarity in string theory, of being able to cut a string diagram, then what was, for example, a hole, what was a hole, if you want to cut it, to say take the imaginary part, for example, then you get 2 boundaries. So 2 boundaries must be the same as a hole. So each boundary must come with a power of g string. If you want to take a closed string, open a hole here, and glue, it's the same as putting a handle. So the adding holes, adding 2 holes, should cost the same as having a handle. So the powers of g-string just come by hand if you want, but come in the string path integral. From the extra boundaries. So in total, we anticipate that the toothed coupling is equal to g string times n. We identified both powers coming, and this is what the toothed coupling is, just from string theory. That's from string theory. This is how, this is the mapping. Of course, if you had studied that non-abelian gauge theories describe the low energy limit of string theories, you knew this already. But I'm just arguing in case you don't remember. Yes?
Are all of the n choices of brains all of them equally probable?
That's right. They are all at the same position. They are absolutely indistinguishable. Okay. So they are absolutely equally probable. Remember, whenever I depict these brains, this separation is zero. This is just for the purpose of drawing the picture. They are really on top of each other. Okay, very good. So, okay. So what are we describing? Still, let's go on with this, trying to understand A. What are we describing? So we have some action for the brain. What is this action for the brain? We know it's super young Mills plus higher derivatives. What do I mean by this? So you have super young Mills, like trace of f squared. But then you can have higher derivatives that come from integrating out the massive degrees of freedom. Yes?
Just to make sure I understood. So is it true that for every string diagram, in this case, we get the, for every diagram, we get the same powers of g and n?
Yes. So what is the total action for the system? We have the action of the brain that describes the massless degrees of freedom, which are young Mills, plus the massive ones. The massive ones, suppose I integrate them out, and those will give rise to higher derivative interactions in super young Mills. Yeah? It's clear? No? If not, just think that I'm taking low energy limit, so I only get massless stuff. So ignore higher derivative. And you can come and ask me at the end. Then, of course, it's not only the brain. We have a term which is the interaction between the brain and the bulk. A term that tells you that there is a coupling between a graviton moving outside here and a gauge field moving here. There will be terms that couple the brain and the bulk. And then there is the bulk, which is the gravity action. Okay? So what is the bulk action? So the bulk, when you are in the bulk, you just have 10-dimensional supergravity. Again, plus the massive mode, so plus higher derivatives. So this action of the bulk will be something like 1 over g Newton, as we wrote the other day, integral of square root of g times r, for example, something like that, which will be, once you define, when you perturb, for example, the metric, and you write the metric to be the flat metric plus some fluctuation to make them canonical and normalized like this, square root of g Newton times the perturbation, this will become integral of dh canonically normalized, as you saw yesterday in the tutorial, plus, and then the coupling would appear here, square root of g Newton times some terms like h, dh square, something like that. Plus, just by plugging this metric inside Ricci and expanding, this would be the kind of term. And I remind you that the relation between g Newton and the string coupling is that g Newton, square root of g Newton is proportional to g string times alpha prime square, where you know that alpha prime is related to the string tension. 1 over alpha prime is the string tension. Very good. Very good, very good. So we have super young Mills, which has coupling lambda, which is dimensionless. And then we have everyone else. So we have these higher derivatives, we have these interaction terms, and we have this bulk part, which all contain dimensionful couplings that contain explicitly alpha prime. So what I'm about to do is to take a low energy limit, where I will consider the limit of low energy. And I'm going to do something which is quite obvious. I'm going to say that gravity decouples. But that's just the obvious statement that at large distances, gravity is not important. So, and I'm just rephrasing it in this effective field theory language, which I'm hoping is familiar. But if not, just ignore all this and just think that in the low energy limit, gravity decouples, because gravity decouples at large distances. And Young-Mills, of course, stays, because Young-Mills has no dimensionful parameters. Yes?
Is the S of interaction what do you obtain from the exponentiation of the vertex operators?
Which interaction?
The middle, the S of S in the action of interaction.
No. Absolutely not. So here we are always describing just the point of view A, where we don't try to find out the background. So we just try to say that when we have some gravitons, they propagate in the bulk, then they have some, they are mediated and create something for the brain, then they interact through the brain, then they are ejected to the bulk, and then they move in the bulk. And I really only do this picture of Feynman diagram. So they are always in flat space. This is in flat space. So I'm always in flat space, and I have my closed strings. They interact in the bulk, then they go to the boundary by the interaction Lagrangian. Then they move in the boundary, do lots of Feynman diagrams in super young Mills. Then there is some source, they get again to the bulk, they interact in the bulk, and I measure them. I'm really just summing Feynman diagrams. Yes?
I have this intuition that gravity is important in large distances, in cosmological distances, that's gravity.
Yes, when you have cosmological constant. Here you have flat space. And you just have a body, and you are going far away, and...
Yeah, but everything else should decouple as well.
No, what I'm saying is that you can... let's go on, and I will do it rigorously, don't worry. Okay. So now, what do I want to do? Now I want to consider... First of all, okay, the statement is the following. So you have some effective action describing the strings, the brain, and so on. You discussed effective actions, right? Freddy told you about effective actions that come from string theory. You remember how you compute effective actions? There are two options. One option is by requiring that the string moves in a background and still describes a conformal field theory. By imposing that the beta function is zero, You derive some equations of motion that follow from some effective action. This was one point of view. The other point of view is by studying string scattering, studying, say, how gravitons scatter. So you study how three gravitons scatter, and you derive a number, and then you derive an effective action which has that number as the cubic vertex of the gravitons, because you want to mimic what you computed in string theory using the rules of string theory. So there are these two options for deriving effective actions at low energy. One is the one Freddy told you about. You write a string action in a general background. You impose that the beta function is zero so that the theory is conformal. You derive equations of motion for the metric and the dilaton and so on. And these equations of motion follow from an effective action. The other approach is you compute scattering of strings in flat space. You compute, say, three gravitons, and you get pi over 6. Then you write an effective action that reproduces that in space-time, where I put some pi over 6 in the correct coefficient so that when I compute it from that action, I get a good number. And I do it systematically by doing more and more and more and more amplitudes to know more and more and more about my effective action. Okay? Again, I am not expecting anyone to follow the technical details, but try to follow the conceptual ideas and the physics only. And one point that you see that in this effective action is that gravity, because it will be moving, gravity in these higher dimensions will come with powers of alpha prime, which is the string tension. Higher derivatives, by definition, come with powers of dimensionful quantity when you integrate massive modes. But Young-Mills has this dimensionless coupling, G Young-Mills N, that is dimensionless. So now let's take the limit where this alpha prime goes to zero. Now, alpha prime going to zero sounds a bit strange. Alpha prime is dimension full. So what we mean is let's consider a low energy limit where we consider scattering of strings. So we consider scattering of strings, for example, or processes which have some momenta. And that momenta is very small. And again, in dimensionless quantities, what I mean is that alpha prime times k square, for example, is much smaller than 1. Or I consider experiments where the distances involved in my experiment over alpha prime are much bigger than 1. So I take this low energy limit. In the low energy limit, in practice, this amounts to taking alpha prime to zero. But carefully, of course. Alpha prime is dimensionful. Right? I always get itchy when people tell me to take dimensionful quantities to zero. But it's in this sense. But in practice, this is what it means. So this guy that doesn't contain alpha prime, this Young-Mills survives. So this one survives. But basically, only this guy survives. Everyone else, it contains powers of G prime, like G Newton contains powers of alpha prime and so on. All those interactions decouple. So we conclude that we get, let me maybe write there, that the picture A, according to A, we seem to get two decoupled systems. One of them is four-dimensional super Young-Mills, which is the compactification of n equals 1. It has n equals 4 supersymmetry. We will describe this theory in detail in two lectures. Plus 10-dimensional supergravity, and they are not speaking to each other. Okay. Let's keep this and move to point B. Move to the approach B, where you try to now, instead of doing all these fancy arguments, now it's simpler. Let's just find the background that these brains create. Okay? What Dalimil was asking. Yeah? Is it clear? So now let's move to point B. So when we move to the point of view B, we want to know what backgrounds do brains produce. So did you answer this question during the strings course? I think Lilia gave you some lectures, no? So what do you know about the backgrounds that D brains produce? Nothing. Very good. Okay, so what do we want to find? We want to do the following. We want to take this low energy limit. So we have the massless modes of 10-dimensional string theory. And we want to see solutions. So, and then we have some effective action at low energies, right? So we start from some effective action that again came from computing the scattering of gravitons, dilatons, and so on, or from imposing that your background was a conformal, gave rise to a conformal theory, which means by imposing that your background is a good background, consistent background, okay? And then in your effective action that you know in particular it contains Einstein gravity, right? So you saw that string theory contains Einstein gravity. It's Einstein gravity plus other fields, plus Ramon-Ramon fields, plus other stuff, but in particular it contains Einstein gravity. So what we should do is take that effection action, take that those generalized, let's call them the generalized Einstein equations that follow from the string effective action, and let's look for a solution which is produced by a heavy body which has this 3 dimensions, 3D dimensions, and 6D dimensions. And ask, what's the background? What's the background? If I'm not putting a heavy point, I'm putting an heavy plane. So I put this plane, right, which is a heavy, these heavy objects, and ask ourselves, what kind of solution could appear? So you make your ansatz. Sorry, your ansatz would be ds squared. What's a very natural ansatz? Well, you have this space here. So eta mu nu dx mu dx nu, where this mu runs from 0 up to 3. So those are the directions in the brain. You have dxm dxm, where this m runs from 4 up to 9. These are the 6 dimensions. And then you could make an ansatz for the metric, say some function f of the distance from this brain, which I would call r, where r square is xm xm, the distance from the brain. And here, suppose, let me normalize it with f tilde of r. So this is an ansatz, a natural ansatz for the background. You plug it into those equations and you see what you get. And what we get is something very simple. One gets f tilde of r is equal to f of r, which is equal to a very simple function, square root of 1 plus l square l to the 4 over r to the 4. Extremely simple background that we will study in a moment. But before, let me just tell you that this L to the 4 is G string N 4 pi alpha prime, where this N comes because there are N units of flux sourced by the N brains. So imagine you have a system where you put N electrons in a box, then in your final background you would find N times the charge of an electron. Here it's exactly the same. You have N brains, each brain sources Ramon-Ramon flux, so at the end you will get N somewhere, and this is where it appears. It appears in this dimensionful parameter L. Yes? by plugging them into these Einstein equations and solving them. Now it is just an ordinary differential equation, and we solve. Okay, very interesting. So this is the background. Let's study this background. Ah, just one comment. Let's go back here and see that this, of course, I can use always, but okay, say this description here is good, and by good, let's be explicit what we mean. We mean it's useful or simple for G string times n, which is the toothed coupling, much smaller than 1. When we have perturbation theory, that's when the approach n equals 4 is a useful description. But of course, this gravity description, it's valid if you have, on the other hand, G string, if you have a large number of brains, and if this is a classical background. So this is valid, this is a good description, so whatever I will put in this background, which will be point B, this is a good description for G string times n much bigger than 1. But again, by good, what I really mean is simple, as we will see. Because this is when classical gravity is applicable. When I have a large number of brains and a classical object, this is when it is useful. So now let's analyze this. Let's go on and analyze this background. And there are two natural limits you can take concerning R. Can someone tell me?
So can I just ask?
Yes.
I didn't really get the argument why that gives you classical gravity when you have lots of brains.
You need to have lots of brains to have some object which is a massive object.
One brain has mass, then you have a massive object when you have one brain, right? So I don't see why you need more brains to get mass.
You see that the radius of ABS, this L, which is a dimensionful parameter there, must be much larger than the string's length. Otherwise, the gravity description is not a good description. If you have a space-time where the curvatures are of order of the string length. So you need that L to be very large for to have this background to be a good description in this low energy limit. Very good. Okay, so now let's analyze this background. Let's study the two obvious limits. One limit, when the radius is very large, when you are very far away from the brains. So this is far away from the brains. And there is a limit where R is going to zero, where this is close, where the limits are, we are close to the brains. Do you agree? R was XM, XM was the distance from the brain. Yes?
Just a detail, shouldn't this be maybe R squared? Because otherwise the dimensions don't match of a prime dimensions of length squared.
Yeah, probably. Let's see. What did I write? Yeah. Alpha prime, of course, is square. Thank you. And indeed, you see, G string times alpha prime square is G Newton. And G Newton is, of course, what should appear when I'm describing gravity, not alpha prime. So it should be the good combination. Very good. Thank you. So now there are these two nice limits that we can take, close to the brain or far away from the brain. If we are very far away from the brain, when R goes to infinity, what do we get? Can someone tell me? You don't need to look at anything. If you have an object and you go very, very far away, what do you get? Sorry? For the metric?
What space.
So when we are very, very far away, of course, ds square just becomes dx nu, it's an eta, plus dxm, which is equal to 10-dimensional Minkowski space. Okay? So this is 10-dimensional Minkowski. So that's okay. That was not so hard. What about the an intent dimension. So what we have is we have the brain. So let's have the brains here. And very far away, here we have gravity flying around. Gravity. So we have 10-dimensional gravity, some strings in 10-dimensional space-time moving around and playing and interacting with each other. What about r going to zero? When r goes to zero, ds squared approaches what? Approaches r squared over l squared, eta mu nu dx mu dx nu plus l squared over r squared dr squared plus l squared, so d omega of a 5-sphere. So please see what I've done. So I've written dxm, dxm in spherical coordinates, and I've separated the radial direction from the angular part. And the angular part is a 5-sphere, because we have 6 dimensions. So 6 dimensions, you have a radial direction and then a 5-sphere. And if you see that from this harmonic action, that would come with the power of r, that would cancel exactly this r squared. It would come with the power of r squared, it would cancel this r squared, and only m l remains. And then you have this space here. So remember that this part came from the dxm, dxm part. And this part here from the dx mu, dx nu part. But now we notice something nice. So this part is a metric of a space-time, which is called a sphere. So this is a 5-sphere. Okay? And this is nothing but the metric of Ante de Sitter 5. 5-dimensional Ante de Sitter space. So let's think a bit about the physics of what's going on. And let's think a bit about what we have just found, which is quite remarkable. We found that when we go away from the brains, we have flat space. And when we approach the brains a lot, we have ADS5 times S5. Now, when we approach the brains a lot, what happens is the following. So let me maybe write it there. So we have that T, okay, so let's write dx mu dx nu is minus, there is a time, minus dt squared plus dx. Now only time will play a role. So what is this time? Let's give it a physical meaning. Coordinates are never physical. So we need to always think a bit before claiming that this is a time and so on. But what is this time? This time, when you go to infinity, you get a flat metric where you really have dt minus dt squared. So for an observer that is not moving at infinity, the proper time is t. So this t is the time measured by an observer at infinity. So this is the time measured by an observer at infinity. What is the time measured by an observer that is at some distance r? Not moving, but at some distance r, away from the brain.
Rescale by the function f?
We have to rescale by this function f. Remember, this is how you always do time dilatation or contraction in general relativity, right? You say that ds squared is always the proper time square. You fix all coordinates to be constant, so ds squared is just dt squared times whatever is there. So ds is just square root of whatever is there times dt. Is it clear? So on the other hand, so this is the time measured by an observer at infinity. On the other hand, if this is the brain, let's put an observer here, and let's have an observer here at infinity. So this observer here, this metric, you have this r over l squared. And r is going to 0, so this guy is going to 0. So you have a huge red shift. Yeah? You have a huge red shift. So the time measured this guy, so the delta, the element of time, which is the proper time for this guy, is equal to r over l times delta t, which is the time measured by the guy at infinity. Yeah? You agree? In particular, the energies that this guy measures, of course, is just the inverse. It's L over R times the energies that the guy at infinity measures. Yeah? Is it clear? So what is happening for this guy? This guy that is here at infinity, suppose he has a friend, okay, that has some shiny ball, right? And this friend decides to move close to the brain. So what's happening as he's moving from the point of view of the guy at infinity? He starts seeing this ball smaller and smaller. And when this guy reaches the brain, he almost doesn't see. The light is really, really dim. The energy that this guy perceives is extremely small. It's R over L times the energy that this guy measures. So when this guy is approaching zero, this object is becoming more and more red, and it looks like it has less and less energy. Exactly as when you throw stuff inside a black hole, and you are from the outside, and you throw some light inside the black hole, you see it becoming more and more red as it approaches the black hole. Yeah? This is familiar. I put it in the wiki that you should revise this stuff from your black hole courses. I don't know if you did that, but you should have. So what does it mean? It means that from the guy at infinity, what are the light excitations? What are the excitations that have low energy? We want to take the low energy limit. What has low energy for the guy at infinity? Well, the stuff that is close to him is perfect. So the stuff that is close to him, of course, we have pan-dimensional gravity. That's close to him, and if you have gravitons floating around close to him, those have low energy. But then, also something else that has low energy is anything that goes close to the brain. If it goes close to the brain, for this guy, it also has low energy. Anything. So you can have something. For this guy, for this point of view, the object that it has here is the same as here. It's the same object, the same light. He's always locally seeing the same light. But for this guy, it became extremely light. Is it clear? So for the guy at infinity, what are the low excitations? It's the ones close to him, the gravity, plus anything. Full string theory close to the brain. Full string theory, not any low energy limit. So here we have strings, the full superstring in ADS5 times S5 plus 10 dimensional gravity. Okay? Then in 97, Maldacena comes along with probably what is the best, the most important idea in theoretical physics of the last 20 years, which is to say that therefore we cross out 10-dimensional supergravity if we have this, and then we arrive at the desired correspondence. So if we have two systems, gravity decoupled from whatever happens close to the brain, or gravity decoupled from Young Mills, then I cancel out gravity, and I get Young Mills equal to strings in ADS5 times S5. So this is, in my opinion, the most powerful idea that we have seen, at least in the last 15 years for sure. In the last 20 years, maybe there is a second string revolution, but I think in really even broader than strings, I think really it's probably the most powerful idea in theoretical physics, which gave rise to a huge amount of developments that we will start discussing next time. You see that the huge advantage over all this blah blah with matrices and so on is that today, I'm telling you, consider strings in ADS5 times S5 background, consider four-dimensional n equals 4 super young Mills. These are two very precise theories, it's not any theory, and they are dual. And this is the power of this decoupling argument. This decoupling argument is a way of generating exact, precise dualities. Conceptually, it doesn't bring a lot compared to what we had seen before, you can say. I mean, of course, you could have two descriptions, all this picture of holes and so on. It was more or less clear. But what this decoupling argument gives in a very sharp way is the fact that the dualities that come out are extremely precise. It's not just some hand waving, some theory is dual to some theory and so on. It's really, this theory should be equal to this theory. Now, if I tell you this theory is equal to this theory, say, okay, so what? Okay, I will compute scattering of strings and energy and dimensions in n equals 4 and so on. I need a dictionary so that this gets some flesh. The dictionary will be the goal of most of the course, but tomorrow we will continue exploring. We will now take this conjecture and pause for a moment and ask what kind of crazy idea are we proposing? Is this compatible with other ideas that we have in theoretical physics? And we will see that there are many remarkable things to be said. So tomorrow it will still be slightly on the speculative side, but I think a bit more solid. And then starting from the day after, we will really start to come back to very well-defined computations and to computing stuff in gauge theory and string theory and understanding how the two match or not. So all this blah blah about effective actions, decoupling, low energy, and so on, again, was just for motivation. I'm not going to use effective actions throughout the course. I'm not going to use flat space anymore. Right now, we are going to discuss n equals 4 super young Mills and strings in ADS5 times S5. We will define very rigorously what these two theories are, and we will see that indeed, once you start computing, they turn out to be dual to each other. Okay? But of course, imagine how could you have guessed otherwise. Okay, see you tomorrow.